Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
The Telegraph. The Telegraph. Podcasts.
Hi there, podcast fans. I'm Tom Gibbs. Welcome to Telegraph Audio Football Club. Today, we review England's comfortable win over Bulgaria and preview their upcoming comfortable win against Kosovo. Are we, stroke I, underestimating the Kosovans? Only time and exactly one football match will tell. Wales and Scotland are looking far less assured than England, neither side convinced at the weekend. What's going wrong with them and how can it be fixed? Plus, Watford bid farewell to Javi Gracia and say hello again to Kike Sanchez-Flores. An opening weekend to remember in the WSL, and it's the reappearance of our favourite wife/agent in A Song for Europe. Let's take you now into the audio recording facility where I have a pared down but extremely well-formed lineup. Just two other Audio Football Club members with me today. The first is Ali Tweedale. How are you, Ali?
I'm wonderful, Tom. How
good.
Are you?
Yeah, I'm thriving, thank you. I'm very much excited by the return of NFL, which is not what this podcast is about. We've got to stay on the soccer track today, but that is...
Maybe a bit later, just at the end. We'll squeeze something in.
We'll do a director's cut. We'll do a sort of a secret bonus podcast.
I do have a topic that comes up that I then somehow lead into the NFL.
Okay.
Mina Rizuki, you've spoilt some bit of the podcast there by announcing it in advance. But you know, fair play.
It's supposed to be a teaser. Now I have to mention it because if I decide to not bring it up, then it's just not going to make sense anymore.
All right. We'll all look forward to that moment. Back to actual football, we will start with England versus Bulgaria. Sadly, no Matt Law with us today in the audio recording facility, but we have got him in pre-recorded form. Here's what he made of it.
So England beat Bulgaria 4-0 in Saturday's Euro 2020 qualifier. That's 14 goals now in three games in qualifying for Gareth Southgate's team. So they're finding it fairly comfortable. Bulgaria did actually have a couple of chances, a couple of decent ones in the first half and one in the second, which will be some area of concern for Southgate. Obviously, once the front three got going, though, Bulgaria couldn't cope with them. That front three for England's looking really exciting now. Sterling is now producing the form for England that he has showed for some time for Manchester City. Harry Kane is Harry Kane. What can you say? I think he will get Wayne Rooney's goal-scoring record. He's on 25 goals now in, I think, 40 appearances for England. Rooney had about 14 goals in 40 appearances, so he is well on his way to beating that record. And Rashford wasn't incredible on Saturday, but he still won a penalty and is playing his part. So that is really encouraging for Southgate. Kosovo on Tuesday are going to potentially produce the biggest test of the group. They've been in very good form, nicknamed the Brazil of the Balkans, I believe. So that could be a bit more interesting. But this group already looks a formality for England.
Fair to say Matt didn't sound terribly enthused by that match. How about you, Mina and Ali? A 4-0 win for England, but not a very interesting game to watch.
I think it wasn't a very interesting game to watch because Bulgaria didn't put up a kind of challenge that maybe we had hoped for.
Yeah, first half especially, they just offered so little.
It was, I don't know what it is. I think it's because their name would suggest, you know, their history would suggest that they would know how to do that. Obviously, if you look at their recent form, it's been so tragic that you shouldn't have really expected anything more than that. It's
been a long time since they were in an international tournament.
Yeah, but you know, I'm one of those people that just feels like... You know,
a bit of nostalgia for them.
Yeah, a little bit like Romanian Hungary stills will scare me. You know, those types of things. Like, it's just like you remember.
I was expecting them to be better than that just based on Euro 96, basically.
Were you expecting Stoichkov to be playing?
Well, no, but I just think that there's an element of that kind of...
They are
just one of those teams that you expect to be better than they are.
You expect competence, don't you?
Yeah,
they played rubbish. Like Ninos.
Yeah, well, at least get the fundamentals right, but they were playing like Faroe Islands, let's be honest, you know?
It's just one of those games that has to happen in qualifying. Let's just... they all get forgotten as soon as the weekend's over, or Monday's over, I should say. But yeah, it's just got to be a box ticked, basically.
Yeah, but you've got to say hats off to Harry Kane, I think. I think there's a mark of greatness in a way to score a hat-trick in games like this. This is how you end up breaking goal-scoring records. You've got to take your chances against teams like this. It, you know, took his penalties wonderfully.
But that's just it. They're penalties. So I don't feel like it's a hat-trick from open
play. All count. It really frustrates me when people say they're just penalties. If you took penalties away, Tottenham would get relegated or something like that. You don't take penalties away.
Well, then that goes to show you what kind of... I'm joking. Earning a penalty is different, though.
He did earn the second one.
Marcus Rashford.
No, Rashford earned the first.
Oh, the first one, you're right.
For the second.
He did earn the second one.
Yeah, and he set up another one, didn't he? So, yeah, it was
fair
good.
Play. I think he's a wonderful striker. But I just would have liked, on this occasion, perhaps to try out a different front line.
Do you agree with Matt, though, Mina, that Kane will go on to beat Wayne Rooney's total of 53 goals for England?
Well, I think he's earned the right to try at least. I think he's one of the most... I think he's a fantastic striker, and I know that he gets a lot of flack. I was listening to quite a lot of shows just over the weekend of people just saying, oh, but look at his stats against the big teams. And I'm somebody who always judges these things a lot. Like, you know, what about the pressures? Can he do it against a big squad? You know, where was he against Croatia? Where was he against... But sometimes I think that when it comes to Harry Kane, it's... Why are you smirking like that?
Because I thought... I presume you were talking about the World Cup Croatia.
Yes.
He scored against them. He scored the winner against Croatia in the Nations League a couple of months later. So.
Oh, no, I meant the World Cup, right. The actual big stage.
Golden boot winner as well at the World Cup, Mina.
Yes, he is. Absolutely. And I know that he gets a lot of flack for the big games, but I don't think that's actually has anything to do with him not actually turning it on in the big games in the same way that sometimes I've criticised Lewandowski in certain games, or Paulo Dybala or whoever it is. But with Harry Kane, I think it's a product of the system. So in the smaller against the smaller sides or against teams like Bulgaria, then England can dominate. And Harry Kane, you'll see, really knows how to take advantage of that and really knows how to, you know, exploit and score. But when it comes to perhaps against teams that are very strong, you know, whether it's your Croatias, not in the Nations League, you know, some of the big sides, then you'll notice that England sort of take the stage of let's try to be predatory, let's try to score from corner kicks, let's try to score from different ways and not necessarily be able to dominate midfield, dominate the game, have possession and find ways of going through, which just sort of makes Harry Kane a little bit less important to the side.
What about Sterling, Ellie? Looked a cut above for England, certainly in the first half. Are England set up to get the best out of him at the moment? It strikes me that he's the sort of player that you could... feasibly retool the entire team and just make it about getting the best out of Sterling.
Oh yeah, absolutely. He is our best player, I think. I do worry slightly about him because naturally he gets he's thought of as a bit of a creator for England, and that's not quite what he is. He's a real goal scorer now, and England don't have the same level of creativity that he benefits from at City. And I think he definitely needs to be the kind of player who's making that run into the box for tap-ins like he was against for that goal from Kane. But if you've also got Rashford and Kane in the front three, you've got three players who are all going to be doing largely the same thing. And I guess in midfield, we don't really have the same players that are going to play those brilliant through balls to get players into the byline, stuff like that.
I think maybe that's the problem.
Yeah, it is a problem. And so I guess in answer to your question, I don't think we are quite set up to get the best of him. And that's a bit of a shame. But yeah, we should be doing everything to get the most of him, definitely.
You mentioned you wanted to see a different front three, Mina. What would you have done for the Bulgaria game?
Jadon Sancho, no?
I know everyone's going crazy about Jadon Sancho, but I think sometimes everything in good time, you know. Okay. I do think that on this occasion, I think Rashford deserves to be called up, deserves to start that game. I thought he did tremendously well. I like the way that he thinks, because you can just see the way that he's on the pitch and he's thinking to himself, right, plan A, I'm not getting the ball, so I need to drop deep, start picking it up. Like, this is what I can do to find possession. I'm going to run at them. I'm going to win my one-on-one duels. And I just, he always sort of goes through like the basics in his head and tries to do what he can based on the environment and the football match. I do think that with a more fluid front three that you can't necessarily get with Harry Kane, right? That it would just be, considering the talent that is there, like you said, Jadon Sancho, Marcus Rashford, Raheem Sterling, have them all sort of interchanging, scoring goals. And against a team like Bulgaria that was set up with sometimes flipping to a back five, you know, or why not try something different? Because you could see how deep they are. You could see how defensive they are. It was difficult to break them down until obviously they give us away the first goal. Why not do something a little bit more different? Why not have movement? Why not test out that the flexibility of changing that front line? Because Harry Kane is more of a traditional number nine. So it'd be nice to see what alternatives you can get. And I think these are the types of matches against teams that defend very deep. It gives you an idea of what you could potentially face. Why not try something different? Alternatively, other sides might, you know, I mean, obviously, smaller teams struggle with someone and the presence of Harry Kane. So maybe, you know, bigger teams won't. And that's when you should try the front three. I really don't know. But I do think there needs to be flexibility and you need to start experimenting about that and the formation changes now.
Kosovo next up for England on Tuesday night. You would expect that is another good chance to see a few more of the squad players. But Southgate saying he's not going to change it around that much. Is that right, Ali? Wouldn't you mix it up a little bit for the Kosovo game?
Yeah, I think there is a danger, just as we've completely misjudged Bulgaria, there's a real danger of underestimating Kosovo. They're actually a really good team. I'd recommend reading Sam Dean on Kosovo's rise, which is on the website at the moment. It's really, really good, really interesting. So they're undefeated in 15 games, Kosovo. They won their Nations League group quite comfortably. They are actually quite good. They beat Czech Republic on Saturday. So I think what Southgate was doing against Bulgaria was trying to play his best, what he thinks, or more or less is he thinks his best team at the moment. Maybe there's a couple of changes you can make, like Trent Alexander-Arnold for Trippier would be the obvious kind of like for like kind of at right back. But I don't foresee too many changes. I think he'll go with another strong team. I think Kane and Sterling, for example, will play as well, and Henderson.
I really hope that Kosovo can qualify.
Yeah, if they make it to Euro 2020, you'd say that's up there with Iceland getting into the Euros.
It's a much better story than Iceland. It's the story of the underdog. It's a story like of a country that has suffered such great madness. And it's funny, you know, because football, we talk about it so much, but then you remember there's certain moments and momentous occasions, like when Iraq won the Asia Cup in 2007, after everything that they've suffered in, you know, in the wars. And then you had Libya winning the African Cup of Nations in 2014. Again, a momentous occasion. And I just feel like Kosovo, with everything that they've gone through, with so many players having already declared for other teams, ones that would have otherwise represented them, the fact that they don't have the organisation, the funding, the support that perhaps Iceland have, who know how to put things in place and have the freedom to do so. To have Kosovo be so good, to come from a region that's so obsessed with football, the national pride, don't underestimate that. And obviously that's why, I mean, I think that this is a country that's so desperate to have something to celebrate. And I just think it's a nice story for football.
Yeah, absolutely. And just going back to what I mentioned about the Nations League. So not only will Kosovo look quite likely to qualify through the group with England, where they're second, they also, having won their Nations League group, will go into a playoff if they don't qualify through the normal qualifying group. But those playoffs will be against Belarus, Georgia and North Macedonia, which they were the lowest tier in the Nations League. And if Kosovo beaten Czech Republic, they've got a great record. They're obviously a team on the up. And looking at that, those fixtures, you'd probably expect them to qualify from that.
So many delicious Nations League permutations still to be explored. But let's turn our attention to the rest of the European qualifiers that took place over the last few days. Germany 2, the Netherlands 4. Germany conceding 4 goals, Mina, doesn't happen too often. There was a wonderful headline I saw in the Mail last week, Das Reboot, to explain what was going on with Germany. But not quite going to plan, is it? Are they still suffering from the after effects of their disastrous World Cup?
Yeah, you would sort of never expect Germany to lose, and then you remember them at the World Cup and you think, oh, is Germany really Germany right now? But listen, this is what they're doing right now is they're trying to transition. They're going from a team that was a little bit more about dominating possession. You know, they benefited a lot from having Jupp Heynckes in the Bundesliga at the time, who created champions out of his Bayern squad. And then obviously Pep Guardiola came in and gave them sort of the how to play the game in many ways, you know, that lateral passing game that dominated the Bayern's, you know, sorry, that Bayern dominated with him in charge. And then that seeped over and moved over to the German national team, and you had Kroos and Khedira, who were in their prime and just amazing in midfield. Right now, they're trying to be a team that's more about transitioning, that's very good in moving fast, but they don't really necessarily have it all coming together. So you can see it's all a bit slow. The back line is nothing short of atrocious at the moment. Sule just doesn't look like he has the pace at the moment at the back, even though that is one of the things that you would describe him as. He is a fast defender. And you looked at him in that match and you just thought to yourself, what are you doing? I don't think that they really understood how to play with that formation, how to play with three at the back. I don't think the wingbacks did enough defensively at times, especially on the left-hand side of the game. So there are so many things that they just need to click, that need to click into place. And with Holland right now and the confidence that they have, it's becoming a little bit difficult for Germany.
Are they the big emerging power in European football at the moment, LA Holland?
Yeah, there's lots to be excited about. I mean, that defence is just amazing, isn't it? De Ligt, Van Dijk and Daley Blind, who's actually quite good now again.
At the age of 44.
I think he is, yeah. He was great for Ajax last season. Really, really great.
He seemed to have found a role where he just sort of sits there and doesn't do much, which is excellent for a man.
He's less vulnerable in a back three with a wing back in front of him. His distribution's amazing. But I do think, yeah, they are exciting. They are still inconsistent. So they obviously beat Germany 4-2 this weekend, but lost to Germany 3-2 not that long ago. So both of those teams have inconsistencies that are a bit of an issue still.
It's strange because when you look at them and you know how we talk about emerging powers, they are traditionally one of the powers of European football. But I obviously they've died a little bit the way that Italy died by not qualifying for the World Cup as well. But then you look at that team and you can obviously pick out the likes of Van Dijk, maybe Frankie de Jong and De Ligt. But then you look at it I'm not sure. I look at their spine and I'm still thinking it's Memphis Depay up front, you know.
The reinvigorated Memphis Depay, no less.
Absolutely. And who does play with a certain level of freedom that he's been granted by Koeman. And then you've got Babel. And you just think to yourself, it's not this front line.
Yeah, they don't really have a goal scorer, do they? That is a bit of an issue. They don't have someone who's going to score, I don't know, penalties like Harry Kane or something like that.
And then, you know, you looked at their midfield against Germany. It's Martin Deroon, who's obviously had a fantastic season with Atalanta and they qualified for the Champions League, and Wijnaldum. But then you wonder whether, if they are facing a really top team, how good their spine will stand up. Because I think that really you pick out maybe Frankie de Jong, and I'm not even going to mention De Ligt and Van Dijk as being the two superstars, but the rest of the team sometimes, I don't know how strong they will be in the very tough tests. And I know that Germany's supposed to be one, but in a team that's decided to play Kimmich in midfield when they don't actually have proper right-back options or anyone in that void as well, I'm not sure, because it just looks like Jogi Löw is doing all the things wrong, which just makes Holland look a lot better.
Proper test coming up for Germany. They face 100% record Northern Ireland. Can the Northern Irish get a result against Germany?
Well done Northern Ireland for having a 100% record, but a bit of caution necessary. They've played four games so far and won all of them, but those four have been two games at home against Estonia and Belarus and two games away against Estonia and Belarus. They've still got four games left, home and away against Holland and Germany. So
this is when the test starts.
I don't know if they can qualify, but you know, who knows? They've got big results before. They normally set up quite solidly at the back and make away teams difficult, make it tough for teams that visiting Windsor Park. So yeah.
I like them without the ball. I think they work really hard.
Yeah, they do. But yeah, getting a goal against Germany might be tough.
Let's move our attention back to the British mainland and talk about Wales. Is it offensive to say British and Wales? I'm sure the Welsh listeners will be in touch. afcpodcast@telegraph.co.uk if you want to point out my ignorance. But Wales just about snuck past Azerbaijan 2-1. Ryan Giggs isn't doing that good a job, is he?
No.
This team should be achieving more.
Yeah, the players that they've got, some of the players they've got in attack, you just think they should be more than they are currently. It's not really been clear what Giggs is trying to change, how he's trying to make the team play. They don't have an obvious game plan that is really noticeable. They've not been very impressive. Snuck past Azerbaijan. Don't really look that likely to get out of that group. It's not looking great. I'm not convinced by Giggs, but obviously there's time for that to change.
I'm not convinced by how he sort of speaks, because sometimes he's like, we need to be faster here, we need to be more patient here. I don't know whether the players know exactly what is being asked of them. I think there seems to be a little bit of a disorganization tactically. I think they don't look like they know exactly what the plan is. You know, should we go for it? Should we stand back? Like, you need to guide us through this. And I think that he's probably also, this is a big job for him, he's probably also learning on the job as well. And he is sort of in charge of this huge transformation right now. You know, they are going with younger talents, but you're going to need, this is when you need the likes of Gareth Bale and hopefully Aaron Ramsey when he comes back to just make the difference until they figure it out on a tactical level.
That's the thing as well, that while they should be better than they are, it's basically because they've got so many good players. But if you look at their population, they really are kind of like, or have been punching above their weight recently. But it's just a bit disappointing. They need to take advantage of this time when they've got so many good attackers.
Yeah, it feels like a generation that could be squandered pretty quickly unless they get themselves in gear. What about Scotland? A desperately poor 2-1 home defeat to Russia for them. Should they be this bad, Ali? There is a little bit of talent in that squad.
I don't really know. They've not got the same sort of star names as Wales, but they've probably got a more consistent team throughout. Certainly better defenders than Wales, I think. They should really be hoping for slightly more. They've now lost 3 of 5 in qualifying. The qualifying from that group's completely gone, really. I'm going to keep talking about the Nations League. They won their Nations League group, so they will get a playoff at least. So now it should just all be about preparing for that. The next 6 months should all be about focusing on peaking in time for those playoffs. And they've got a chance, but yeah, they are quite underwhelming, really.
But it is Russia. I mean, their group is difficult. They do have Belgium and they have Russia, and I don't know why people have really underestimated Russia right now. I mean, if I'm facing them as a big nation, if I'm the Netherlands, I would also be a little bit worried about them. They're perhaps not a team that always does fantastically well in every occasion. We obviously saw them in the World Cup. They are also a side that are just a bit further ahead in terms of where they are right now, in terms of finding their identity and trying to qualify for this tournament. So perhaps a little bit ahead of where Scotland are. And I do think that as good as they can be, that team, you do see moments where they don't make the most of what is good in that squad, whether it's leaving the striker a little bit isolated because they've dropped too deep or not really understanding. I don't know. I felt a little bit sorry, actually, for McBurnie.
Talk us through the McBurnie thing, Mina.
We can obviously talk about the video where he said what he said. I meant more on a tactical level. I do also feel sorry for him in the sense that I just feel like right now everyone just expects you to be a robot that always says the right thing and always do the right thing. And at the end of the day, you know, you're like, okay, well, you're a representative, you're a role model for the children. But he didn't ask to be a superstar. He asked to be a footballer. And he's not going to be perfect. He's going to say what he wants to say. He's looking at something, which is his team, that are not doing well right now. They're not a Germany, okay? I mean, they're not a side that is going to be, yeah, we're going to, you know, trod on everyone. And he just came out and said something to one of his friends. And I just feel like it's a little bit crazy about the backlash that he received, because then what you're doing is creating a generation of people that just say the right things but feel entirely different. So it's a generation of manipulators.
Yeah, I agree completely, really. I guess just it's the backlash to it is going to increase it, isn't it? People are so angry about McBurnie not appreciating sort of being in the position he is, that it's just going to make other players less likely to speak out, which is quite frustrating, isn't it? Or not speak out, but like be honest.
But is this, I wonder, because I don't know, because I feel like I've lived here all my life, but I don't get why we need to be so censored about things. You know, like why is it so weird to be a guy who wants to win. Like, you know, the things that we fall and we start like criticizing is, oh, Ronaldo and his clear desire to win. McBurney not wanting to play and feeling like, you know, does he really want to go up with this team? That's, let's be honest, it's going to find it difficult, you know?
Seamless transition from Ronaldo to McBurney there. I mean, never seen it done before. Finally, Ireland, who got a draw in Switzerland, their top of their group after five games, but now they play a friendly against the aforementioned Bulgaria. Wasn't the Nations League supposed to end all this madness, Ali? I thought we were done with international friendlies, basically.
Oh, yeah, explain this to us, Ali.
It's quite a simple explanation. Ireland are in a group with five teams. There are other teams, groups with six teams. That leaves a weekend off for each team in the qualifying process. Oh. So they have to play a friendly.
I'm going to exclusively reveal something. I'm not going to watch that football match.
No, I don't think many people will. But yeah, no, it's a good time for Ireland. Yeah, they've got every chance of qualifying. Slight concern since Robbie Keane's gone, and I don't know if Shane Long's still about. But where I don't really know who their goal scorer is. Ireland. They had four strikers in their current squad and had one international goal between them, and that was scored in their last game just before the weekend. So yeah, that's the only concern really. But yeah, exciting times. Dublin's hosting a few Euro 2020 games. So
yeah, that's why I think it's so important for them to do well.
Let's get Ireland there.
Yeah.
And Scotland, because Scotland are hosting some as well.
Mm. Fingers crossed.
Yeah, but they have heart, Ireland. They come back. They're like, we're not going to lose this. We're going to do everything we can.
Fun fans as well.
I kind of like this.
Yeah, but that was the thing, wasn't it? That, like, we're not just here to have a sing-song. Was that Roy Keane that said that? We'll return to Roy Keane very, very soon after this short bit of audio content.
Hello, podcast listeners. My name's Danny Boyle, and I'm The Telegraph's Commuter Editions editor, which means it's my job to provide you with great journalism that makes your journey to and from work as enjoyable as possible. I can't prevent train delays or guarantee you won't get caught in the rain, but I can make sure you're up to date with the best of The Telegraph every morning and evening. And I just wanted to let you know about one of the ways you can get all that in audio form. All you need to do is join my WhatsApp group. Every weekday, my colleague Chris Price and I bring you short audio briefings directly to your smartphone at 8 in the morning and 5:30 in the afternoon. And the best bit? It's completely free to sign up and easy. Just click on the link in the show notes for this episode. I look forward to having you as a group member soon.
Let's move into a section of the programme which I am calling Spat Watch. We have had several arguments in the past week or so, and I want to know whose side you're on in each of the following cases. Michael Owen versus Alan Shearer. This was a proper public falling out, albeit conducted over social media. Shearer doing some jokes about Owen's wages. Owen then claiming Shearer nearly joined Liverpool. Who's winning? Who do you want to win? Whose side are you on?
Ali, you're looking at me. I'm not on anyone's side. I can understand both.
Neutral like Switzerland.
It's weird. I can actually understand both their point of views. And I think that what they're doing is judging the other person by what they think is, by who they are, if that makes sense. So Shearer is the kind of guy that would just die for his club, that will give you his limbs if he has to, if it means a win. And, you know, he's one of those really faithful servants that is a warrior on the pitch and really fights for everything. And I think that he just sort of, it's like that thing that you have with big players who become coaches. They just don't understand people who aren't like them. Mm. You know, they just don't understand if your midfield is not as clever as you were when you were a player, you know. And so then he's looking at Michael Owen and thinking, I need you. This is the last day. And if, you know, we don't actually know what happened between them, you know, and the conversations they've had or anything like that. And he's probably thinking to himself, if it was me in your position, I don't mind being in hospital after this. Whereas perhaps with Michael Owen, he's probably thinking, you haven't gone through the injuries that I have. You haven't seen the pain that I've suffered. And I just really don't want to be put into this. No, you know, this isn't the end all and be all of my life. I do certainly want to at times put myself a little bit first. And you sort of understand that after everything he's been through too.
Yeah, and the World Cup was just after that final game of the season. So that's what Owen didn't want to get injured for. You can understand it, but I'm probably slightly more Team Shearer here. Sorry?
Because you are more that kind of guy.
Well, I just think Owen, he says things like he never wanted to join Newcastle. I don't he didn't say anything about having a gun to his head. Did he have to do that? He ended up making the choice to join Newcastle. Once you're there and your team are moments from getting relegated, you should be doing anything to keep them up. You should be playing it at half fit.
Yeah, no, I mean, listen, my favourite player ever, like, in the English Premier League is Roy Keane, so I totally get, like, dying for the cause.
We keep
but...
going back to Roy
well,
Keane.
Well,
there's only one way this
let's
is
Let's engage
going.
Now with Roy Keane. Roy Keane versus Alex Ferguson. It's a one-sided spat at the moment, but in an interview with the Irish sports show Off the Ball, Roy Keane basically accused Alex Ferguson of nepotism. He said Darren Ferguson was in the United team, won a league medal, was very lucky to. He said Ferguson didn't always act in United's best interest because of how he recalled players from Preston, and that he wasn't a good man manager because of how his time ended at Man United, and he mentioned Bruce as well. Whose side are you on there?
Fergie, all the way. Yeah. It's literally anyone but Roy Keane. Roy Keane is just a great footballer, brilliant footballer, undeniable. Just an absolute, I'm struggling not to say a word that isn't allowed to be said on this. He's just a really not a nice person. Just, he's the only person in the entire planet that would have find a way of just ranting about Ferguson not finding problems with Sir Alex Ferguson. The best manager of the entire Premier League era, was responsible for so many trophies that Roy Keane ended up winning. And he just goes off on one about him. It's just so, so stupid.
This is where my NFL thing comes in, by the way.
Yes, please.
What I was going to tell you was that New England Patriots, right? Bill Belichick and Tom Brady. And you sort of don't necessarily feel like they love each other, but they both needed each other to win. And I do think that for all those wins that we're talking about Alex Ferguson, I don't know if he would necessarily have them without Roy Keane in midfield. And I don't know anyone would have put up with Roy Keane the way that Sir Alex Ferguson did in many ways. But what I'll tell you is when you watch that guy against Arsenal and when Patrick Vieira is picking on Neville and he goes out there and screams.
Yeah, amazing player.
How can that guy not deserve to walk out the front door? How can that guy deserve to not have his last season? I don't care if I don't care if whatever happens, you suck it up, it's his last season. He deserves to walk out the front door. He deserves to be looked at as not as a guy that we terminated mutually his contract. I don't know if he's in many ways one of the reasons why I actually watched the Premier League when I was younger.
Absolutely.
I feel sorry for him with that.
You feel sorry for Roy Keane.
Weirdly enough, I feel
on the entire
you just feel like for him and Shearer, like it matters so much to them.
Yeah.
And they are a little bit too passionate sometimes. And Roy Keane is way worse than obviously Shearer is, but it's like crazy passionate. But at the end of the day, I mean, we talk about that video like it was a nuclear weapon. It's true. He does. It is a little bit like, oh my God, we can't ever show it again. You've criticized some people, like
the Keane criticizing the players on MUTV.
MUTV, and it's just like, you know, and then you know who he is. You know what I mean? This is the kind of guy he is. Everyone in the dressing room that you know never liked him. It's crazy, but
I get that. I just think it's 20 years on, more than, I don't know.
Yeah, he still seems very
20
bitter.
20 years on, they won so much together. Like you say, they wouldn't have won it without each other. They were two personalities that clashed horribly. I get that, but just bury the hatchet. Come on, like, just be happy.
Yeah, I agree with you.
You guys have had so much success together. Why does he feel the need to go talking about Ferguson like this?
Because it's like the one guy that burned you who was supposed to love you more than anything. It's like a father figure.
Unedifying, but utterly compelling to watch, unfortunately. Probably appeals to my very worst instincts how much I enjoyed watching that full video of Roy Keane. Finally, Christian Eriksen versus Spurs. Christian Eriksen said last week, I wish I could decide my own future like it was Football Manager. Ali Tweedale, noted Spurs fan. Whose side are you on here?
I completely understand Eriksen's frustrations, but Tottenham were holding out for a fee. Eriksen's a really, really important player for them. It wasn't worth it for them to try and get rid of him for just to make 50 million rather than lose him for free next year. We've already seen this season how much difference he makes for them. In my book, it's right for Tottenham to just keep him and get the most out of him for another year. I can understand exactly where Eriksen's coming from. He's probably outgrown Tottenham. He wants to go to something bigger and better and win stand a better chance of winning things. But yeah, Tottenham here.
I could see both sides to this exactly. That
Nina Rizuki, you're so on the fence today.
I know, and I'm never like that. I know. Maybe I'm just tired of the abuse, so I'm just going to sit on the event.
Let's leave it there. Let's talk about the Premier League, which returns next weekend. We've got a managerial change already. Javi Garcia sacked by Watford at the weekend, and it is the familiar face of Kike Sanchez. Flores back at Vicarage Road. Is this a good move for Watford, Mina, to nip it in the bud early? They'd started the season horribly. But they've also now got rid of the only manager who has offered any sort of stability to them, seemingly. He's the first manager for years and years to do more than a full season for Watford.
And a higher win percentage than Kike Sanchez Flores.
Not far apart, though, are they? They're both towards the top of that list of everyone they've had since the Pozzos came in.
Mm. Isn't it like he was 45% and the other one was 31%? Kike Sanchez is 31%.
I might be entirely wrong.
Right. I could be too.
Can picture a bar graph in my mind that I saw somewhere.
Really? Okay. Listen, it's a very difficult one. Like, you sort of this, you know, that this is the way that this management has done things. They like to sack coaches. Chelsea have done it one consistently. Who's to say what's right or wrong on this occasion? Better to do international week. Probably should have done it a little bit earlier than that, right? So you can have the full 2 weeks with under your new management. But either way, I'm not entirely sure going back to an ex that you sacked who had a reasonably good season, you know, reached the semi-finals of the FA Cup, came 13th. But despite that, you know, they did really trail off badly at the end. And I know that people were like outraged that he was sacked initially, but you sort of also could see the signs of things waning. And he hasn't necessarily had this career afterwards that makes you think, ooh, they did a bad, you know, it was a bad idea to get rid of him. He does seem to eventually lose the dressing room. He has fallen out with some big players, even Atletico, which was his most successful stint. He fell out with Diego Forlan. There's just something about him that sometimes makes you think, is he really going to be the guy that offers you the kind of stability, the kind of consistency that they're looking for to build on and to become this force that they're trying to be? I'm not necessarily in agreement with who they've chosen to go with, but right now I think it just seems to be like they have this pot that they go to whenever that, you know, they need to get a manager in, and he's just part of that pot.
Part of the reason he left as well was that he fell out with the club's hierarchy. So it just, the Pozzos are crazy and will fire people whenever they feel like it. They've already done it with Flores once. It just looks like it's going to happen again. I'm saying it now. By the end of the season, Flores won't even
maybe
be
they'll
there.
Bring
something
in,
will go wrong.
Maybe they'll just bring Javi Garcia back.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. A wonderful roundabout. What about Man United, Leicester, Ali? Big game for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer potentially this weekend.
Yeah, huge and quite exciting because it's right on that cusp of people talking about Leicester breaking into the top six, talking about Man United maybe dropping out of it. It's a really exciting game. There's definitely a more positive feeling about Leicester at the moment than there is about United. So, I'm looking forward to that one.
I think United could shock us.
Yeah, quite possibly.
I'm just interested because the tactical matchup, you know, like a counter-attacking team versus a side that plays more like of an expansive game and, you know, a little bit more about possession, which one will end up winning.
Yeah, Brendan Rodgers has had some really good days at Old Trafford as well, hasn't he? He had that 3-0 when he just put Sterling in the hole, and he just had acres of space to work in, and Liverpool just battered United. So yeah, it was very exciting.
I'll feel really sorry for United if they lose this one.
Oh, come on, Mina.
I don't know why.
Come on. Pull yourself
together. I just
want
Rashford to score.
Feeling sorry for Roy Keane and Manchester United.
Yeah, something's gone awry. Something strange.
I'm so in love with the big players and the big teams. I hate seeing them, like, you know, go through a bad moment.
Oh, I love it. It's part of what makes football so good.
Lovely bit of music there from Claude and the Faceless Technocrats to welcome Song for Europe, Mina. It's back, and so is our old friend Wanda Nara, who doesn't seem overjoyed about her husband Mauro Icardi's move to PSG.
Oh, I kind of feel sorry for her. I actually feel sorry for her too. Oh my God, you're going to just shout at me now, yeah? I get it. She's an agent for Mauro Icardi. She talks too much. She's put him into a lot of trouble. She's also his wife. But, you know, listen, they asked her about this move, and she's saying, for me personally, as a wife, where my children are going to school in Milan, yes, it's obviously not the best move because we're now having a long distance marriage, you know, where the father's not around and he's so close to the family, where they just have this brand new apartment in Milan. They did kind of want to stay in Italy because that's where their life is. So she's saying on a personal level, this is not the best move for me. But on a professional level, I think they're thrilled that it's PSG because it's obviously a big club. It's obviously a great move for Icardi, having moved from Inter. Juventus was the where they wanted to be. But if you can't get that, then how much better is it to just play with the likes of Neymar and Kylian Mbappe every day?
Staying with Italy, there seems to be this enormous exodus from the Premier League to Serie A this season. Mkhitaryan the latest to end up there. Are there any names in this latest group of players who are going to be completely rejuvenated by Serie A, like Jovinho and Salah were?
Yeah, it's a difficult one. I mean, a lot of this does have to do with the growth decree tax and also like just the fact that Italy right now just gives you a sort of like an excuse to not pay too many taxes right. If you come to them. So it's a very, for those people who want to make money, you just look at that and you think this is great for the players who have any foreign money coming in and for the clubs who don't need to pay tax only on half of 50% of the wages. So that's one of the reasons why there's all these players wanting to come to Serie A. I think the other reason as well is because when you have people like Ronaldo and De Ligt choosing to go there, you're thinking to yourself, maybe this is a team Antonio Conte's back in Inter. There's now something more of a league. Ancelotti's at Napoli. This is going to be perhaps a little bit exciting. I'm interested to see what was happening with Mkhitaryan and Smalling, but we don't know what Paolo Fonseca is going to be like. I mean, you've seen Lucescu, who was the former coach of Shakhtar, say, well, he just built on what I created. So we're not entirely sure this is his baby. This is going to be his first, you know, time, I guess, in Serie A to just have his own team to do something special. I think that Mkhitaryan's had a great, well, he did really great in the qualifiers. Maybe he'll be the guy that changes them, but it's not a position that's very important to Roma. I think Smalling could be interesting to watch, but I think that it's going to be Lukaku from anyone that's coming out who's going to make the difference because it's Antonio Conte.
Can I just ask one thing about that? With Chris Smalling, obviously, English players quite rarely go to Italy. I imagine it might be something that people get half excited about. Are people actually excited when they see Chris Smalling signed? I mean, it's the kind of signing that a big club in England would be like, what is my team doing? But, I mean, I'm not saying that he's bad or will be bad, but is that something that might get people excited in Italy?
I think it's exciting only because he's Manchester United.
Right,
I think that they're very much aware of his flaws. I think they are. When you see the alternatives that were being mentioned at the time, you just think to yourself, oh God, let it be Smalling, if that makes sense. Okay. So I think that when they've looked around and they've realized the potential of who could come in and do that job for them, they just thought Smalling is the best one because at least he's played for United. At least he has big game experience. At least he can, you know, he understands what to do on certain occasions in a way that some of his the potential arrivals would have done. Lovren was another one, actually.
Oh, yeah.
But we're not too in love with him because he's very much in love with himself.
So. What about Romelu Lukaku, Mina, racially abused last weekend? And then there was that really strange statement from the Internazionale fans saying that he shouldn't be offended by it. Tell me about what the setup is in Italy for this. Is there like a kick it out or any kind of institutional like desire to do anything about this problem? Or is that it? Is that, you know, Inter fans put the statement out and now that's as far as it goes?
Basically, pretty much, yeah. There are ways of applying the rules in matches should you hear anything, any racist chanting, anything that potentially could disturb the player or anything that's horrendous in that way. You are supposed to, you have a protocol, and UEFA has also released the same protocol, so we know what it is. We have the rules in place. We have the technology to identify, to name and shame the fans that commit such atrocities. But unfortunately, I just think a lot of the times applying that law is something different because I don't think referees feel that they have the power or want to necessarily have the power to stop games should such things arise because they're like, well, my first concern is public safety. So if I stop this game, is this going to all descend into chaos and madness? So I need to have the officials, you know, with me, the Italian Federation being like, okay, we're going to stop this game. We agree with you and we're going to help you out when this happens. They don't feel supported. Other referees who have refereed in the game before, Italians, have said, this is crazy. You should have that power. You are supposed to be the moral authority on that football field and you should never let a player feel that way. So there's this whole discussion taking place. But at the moment, what you have in Italy is a lot of people who say the right things, but not necessarily go on to actually show this commitment to saying to doing the right things. And I mean, Inter came out, we're discussing Cagliari now, but Inter were fans themselves who released that atrocious statement. they don't represent the whole Inter fans. Can I just say this? Because there was another statement that was then released saying this is just abysmal. We can't believe that this statement was initially released, all of this business. And Inter, who did racially abuse Koulibaly, their fans, a certain section of them at the time, what I thought Inter did really well was not appeal, was allow the fact that their stadium was closed for two games and they're one of the teams that, you know, always bring in a lot of fans and make a lot of money out of it. So they didn't appeal it. They tried to do something about it, but it's not enough. I think that you can't just ask only the clubs to do something. You have to have the whole federation supported. You need to bring in the cameras. You need to point out who these guys are that are doing this. You need to ban them from the statement. You need to put them into jail. And then maybe this will stop these things happening.
You need docked points, surely.
Something like that. Absolutely something like that.
I don't think stadium bans are really going to, for fans that really want to get there, they will still manage to.
It's not enough. Yeah, your stadium bans are not enough.
If Cagliari got docked 5 points, then all of a sudden they're in a much worse position.
Well, their president would do certainly a lot more in identifying who the culprits are and making sure they never come back. Yeah.
Happier stuff in England this weekend, where the WSL returned 63,000 at the games across the weekend. Interestingly, more at Man City, where they were charging for tickets, than there were at Chelsea, where they gave them away for free. But it seems like a good decision, Ali, to start the season with the women's teams playing in the bigger stadiums.
Yeah, absolutely. Hopefully a load of the people that go to those games really enjoyed it and will also now go to the games when they're not at the big stadiums. So yeah, looks better on telly, doesn't it? Really, really positive to have so many people go. But slightly disappointing that so many didn't turn up with their free tickets to Stamford Bridge.
There's something strange about that, isn't there? Yeah. I think there is a question about when you do give something away for free, it is less appealing, isn't it? I think even a token amount of money is a more attractive proposition to...
Well, it's easier to... If you've paid £5, you might think, I don't want to let that go to waste. But if you've just filled in a form and got a ticket for free,
You're more likely to let it go to waste.
Yeah, but there's 25,000 at Stamford Bridge or something like that? Still good. Mm. Great to have that many there.
Yeah. Do you think they can keep the momentum going all season, Ali? Obviously, Women's World Cup was a tremendous success. It felt like a much bigger deal than it has done in the past. I know you spoke to Beth Mead last week. Was she feeling positive about the direction of the league?
Yeah, the players are really positive, but they also kind of, Beth in particular was saying to me, she thought it's all small steps. Let's not go start thinking we're going to sell out the Etihad and Stamford Bridge every week. That's not going to happen. They know that they need a domestic TV deal just to get a bit more exposure. But yeah, they're really positive. They say they're going in the right direction. She's getting used to getting recognised in the street and stuff like that, which is amazing. It's all very positive. There's a really positive feeling about it, and it's good. It's great to watch.
Yeah, and two brilliant goals this weekend that won the big derbies: Caroline Weir for City against United, and Beth England for Chelsea against Spurs. Which was your favourite?
This City goal was
agreed.
It was just beautiful. It reminded me of Andy Robertson, the way she struck that ball, just kind of like coming in off the left, hitting it. Basically, the exact direction she was running. Really, really, really good goal.
Yes, plenty more of that, please. That's your lot for this week. We'll be back with you next week, along with the Premier League. Surely, plenty of football to discuss. You can contact me on Twitter if you like. Before then, it's at Tom with an H Gibbs. Don't forget to send us an email as well. Let us know if you're enjoying the show, or if you're not. We'll probably read out the best of what you send us, not so much the negative stuff. No one wants to hear that. It's a podcast. You're listening to it for joy. afcpodcast@telegraph.co.uk is the email address. Subscribe to Audio Football Club by typing those words into wherever you get your podcasts and probably tapping on the place where it says subscribe. You can do it. Thanks to Joel Grove on the buttons. Thanks to you for your company. I'll talk to you again soon.